disciplining.
Yeah.
So accordingly, it mostly emphasizes only that during the first 7 years, disciplining should not be performed.
Okay.
It's only playing. Okay? Of course, there's no doubt that the narration indicates that the first 7 years is specifically for playing. And in this age, the child must be left to play and not to be disciplined. But is playing forbidden during this period? The next period that is of disciplining? Of course not. But it should be emphasized on disciplining, not emphasized on playing. As the first period of 7 years is emphasized on playing and not disciplining.
So I just feel like generally right now the parents, when they hear this, they feel like, how is it possible that the first 7 years of the child is just allowed to play? There is no rules. There is no like, okay, don't do this, do that. So there is some slight kind of...
Yeah, that's why we say we emphasize on playing.
Okay.
But disciplining should be there in its play.
Like,
right?
A minor, you know, like...
Yeah. In the form of play even.
Yeah.
Learning should be there in the form of play also.
So it
and
has
that's why
to be
we
done
see kids,
very...
you know, when they're taught something, they learn so fast, but while playing, while they're happy, while they want to experiment something on their own.
Yeah.
So emphasis is made on play, but disciplining should be there in its own way.
So I
learning should be there.
You have to like, you know, put the correct balance and...
Yeah. And this, the next, you know, 7 years is for disciplining, emphasis is laid. So it doesn't mean playing should be reproached for, no.
Yeah,
playing should be done. But disciplining is the main factor here.
Yes, definitely. So thank you very much, and I'm sure we all learned a lot. And inshallah, we're going to try and be more, you know, aware on how we're supposed to be with our children and how important it is to play with them as well. Thank you very much. And dear audience, thank you for joining us on this program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Inshallah.
European News Bulletin.
Leaders from around the world have congratulated former Vice President Joe Biden on winning the U.S. presidential election, despite allegations of electoral fraud from sitting President Donald Trump, who has so far refused to concede. World leaders are already preparing for a new approach with hopes the U.S. will rejoin the World Health Organization in the Paris Climate Accords. In the U.K., talks of a U.S. trade deal have come with caveats of the Good Friday peace agreement, which weakens the U.K.'s negotiating stance when it comes to Brexit, something Downing Street was not too concerned about with Trump. In Iran, the government remains cautious, even though Biden has made rejoining the Iran nuclear deal one of his priorities. Iran has maintained that international law is the bedrock of negotiations and unlawful sanctions must be removed before any further dialogue. Well, let's talk to political commentator Mohsen Abbas about that story. Good to see you again, Mohsen. So Trump says it's not over yet. World leaders are congratulating Biden. What's the state of play here?
Well, of course, it is a bit premature, although this is the normal customary reaction. Whenever an election is declared in the way it has been, world leaders usually do congratulate the new president or the incumbent. However, in this instance, of course, there's never been such a kind of heavy, if you like, dose of allegation. And at the moment, that's all they are, because Donald Trump hasn't presented any evidence of a fixing of the elections. But there's certainly a large stir. However, you know, it's really quite premature in the sense that not the official electoral college, which is yet to meet and cast their votes, hasn't been declared Biden the president. Many are arguing the electoral college can't decide anything until lawsuits and court proceedings take place, others are saying. Of course, court proceedings will definitely happen. They're going to happen in Michigan. They're going to happen in Wisconsin and Georgia and Pennsylvania. They may happen in Arizona as well and Nevada. But the Supreme Court is interesting on this because the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett, who was actually appointed by Trump, is obviously something which Trump can look to. And the Supreme Court is looking at Pennsylvania already. All of this, of course, augurs badly for American democracy, and the possibility of conflict, continued conflict, is definitely there.
All right, we'll have to wait and see. But the reason world leaders have rushed to congratulate Biden, do you think it's because there is a sense that the majority of nations wanted for Biden to win, to sort of restore a sense of normality? And do you think a change of administration would mean a change of policy in any meaningful way?
Well, absolutely. They wanted, I think, Biden to win. Certainly his allies across NATO and various others would probably prefer him to win, although the Saudi Arabians haven't declared their acknowledgement of the new presidency. Other than that, his usual allies have. And that is because, you know, he tore up the Paris Agreement, as you mentioned. He tore up the Trans-Pacific treaties. He was destabilizing on so many levels international agreements that, mm-hmm. of course, they want him to rejoin the pack. Of course, JCPOA was the biggest problem of all, which brings in...
Let me put this final question to you before we run out of time. Biden has said he'd re-sign the U.S. into international institutions and agreements, and I want to talk about specifically the Iran nuclear deal. Is Iran to take Biden for his words, briefly?
Iran certainly won't. I don't think their policy is going to change unless, of course, we get a situation where the Americans drop economic sanctions, accept JCPOA as was agreed, arguably, but even that is in question. I think the Iranians are right not to trust Biden because Biden is a nasty imperialist aggressor himself. You know, he's a Zionist, he's a declared Zionist, so is Kamala Harris. You can't expect any change in their support for Israel and their injustice across West mm-hmm. Asia. So why should Iran trust Biden any more than Trump?
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Mohsen Abbas, political commentator. Thank you, as always. We're going to stick with the U.S. elections as concerns over a transition process linger. The U.S. Vice President, or President-elect, has already gotten down to work. Joining me now, Richard Sudan, to tell us what Joe Biden has been up to. Richard, good to see you.
So, of course, Saeed, the world is continuing to react to the news that Joe Biden is now the president-elect and he'll be the next president of the United States. And, of course, Joe Biden has delivered a speech which everyone is talking about over the last couple of days. The speech was very interesting. Of course, it was full of the kind of usual platitudes you might expect, especially in the wake of a divided country. And there were several nods to Obama within the speech from Joe Biden and also Kamala Harris. But I thought what was interesting in the speech is that Joe Biden said Black America had his back and he is going to have theirs. Now, this is extremely significant. Now, of course, it sounds good on the face of it, but a lot of critics have basically said, look, Joe Biden has not got a good track record regarding Black America. Of course, he was one of the architects of the 94 crime bill, which saw thousands of black people incarcerated. And of course, you know, the fact is Kamala Harris has been on record actually saying that she's not going to do anything specific for black Americans. And I think the reality is that black Americans are dealing with grave injustices in the U.S. They have been for many, many years, and that continues. So I think there's
Now that they've got the vote and they've won the presidency, they're going to go on and forget all about black Americans.
Well, I think this is the kind of cynical take that a lot of people, frankly, are having. And I think now the task really for many people is that they're going to have to hold Joe Biden's political feet to the fire, so to speak, to make sure he makes good on his promises to black America. Of course, over the summer, we've seen massive Black Lives Matter protests throughout the country in the wake of the George Floyd killing. But of course, black injustice, killings at the hands of the state and also militia groups, some would say often working working with the state have been carrying on for many, many decades, and it seems a stretch to imagine that's going to change anytime soon.
We'll talk about the militia soon. Bring us the online reaction to this story.
So let's go first to a tweet from filmmaker and activist Tariq Nasheed, who says, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were saved by the black vote. They and the Democrats need to be reminded of this every day as they try to use benign neglect tactics against the very black voters who saved them while they prioritize other groups. A very strong reaction there. And we have a tweet here from journalist Abby Martin, who says, great that Trump is out, but 7 million more people voted for him than in 2016, and COVID is the only reason he barely lost. Biden and surrogates now calling for unity and bipartisanship is a clear signal he'll govern for the GOP centrists and not progressives. Let's get back to fighting the system that bred Trump. Of course, nationalism has been and is on the rise in the United States, and so too is Trumpism, and that's not going to dissipate anytime soon.
Nationalism and Trumpism. Let's move on to your second story. We're going to stay in the United States and threats of violence by some of Donald Trump's far-right militant supporters.
Again, it has been and remains extremely dangerous in the U.S. if you're a black American. And now we see that the alleged Proud Boys leader has declared the standby order has been rescinded, of course, in the wake of the Trump loss. Of course, Trump infamously said, stand by, stand down. And now those very groups that took that as a signal are now saying in the wake of Trump's loss, the time to arguably do what they do is now, and this is extremely worrying. These groups are terrorist groups. People characterize them as that, and they are intent on malicious violence and attacking black people, etc. So everyone's discussing this right now. I want to bring up first, if I can, a reaction on this very point. Let's go to a tweet from an online activist known as Great Black Shark, who says, B1 fam, listen up. Parler is a right-wing white supremacist site where extremists congregate. I monitor them constantly. This is a message between the chairman of the Proud Boys and other members. Stay ready to neutralize any threat. They will be looking for soft targets. And I think we can see an image of the internal conversation on Parler between these Proud Boy individuals who are basically saying, now is the time, stand by no more and roll out. This is extremely dangerous, and people think this should be viewed as a very serious terrorist threat, specifically targeting black Americans. We have another reaction here from What's the Video, who says, my friend in Washington State said the Proud Boys are posting, stand by, no more, roll out. This is crazy. A reminder that this is a nationwide phenomenon, a nationwide problem. And I think if the new president-elect wants to be taken seriously, he needs to take some serious measures to bring about a system of justice for black Americans where there's been an ongoing system of injustice for many, many years.
All right, Richard Sudan. Richard, thank you as always. All right, time now to look at some other stories this hour. Celebrations in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku, after the country's president, Ilham Aliyev, announced that his country's forces had taken Shusha, the second largest city in the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. Armenia, however, has denied the town's loss and says fighting is ongoing. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has congratulated the Azeris, saying he believes the remaining lands will be captured too. More than 1,000 people have died in nearly 6 weeks of fighting in and around Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountainous enclave internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but populated and controlled by ethnic Armenians. Thousands have rallied in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, to protest against the results of last week's parliamentary election, accusing the governing body of rigging the polls. The country's Central Election Commission said the ruling Georgian Dream Party won more than 48% of the ballots, with the largest opposition party, United National Movement, UNM, 27%. Eight opposition parties, including UNM, have said they'd boycott the parliament. Protesters rallying outside the Central Election Commission demanded the government hold another vote. So far, the ruling Georgian Dream Party has denied all accusations of fraud. Fears have been raised of the global economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic triggering new security threats, potentially leading to World War III. Perhaps in preparation for such a scenario, Britain's military is asking for the Treasury to enable long-term investments needed to modernize. Meanwhile, the UK is selling billions of pounds worth of arms, regardless of the human rights records of some of its customers, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernising and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter. Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come. And this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And so I think possibly what's emerging here, perhaps more likely than the real worry about regional conflicts becoming a world war, is that actually it's a timely opportunity for General Carter, as head of the UK Armed Forces, to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A coronavirus vaccine developed by Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech has been found to be more than 90% effective in immunizing people against the virus. Tested on 43,500 people across six countries, the vaccine has posed zero safety concerns so far. The companies say enough safety data will be required by the third week of November to then take the vaccine to regulators. There are currently dozens of COVID-19 vaccines, all of them in stage three trials, but this joint American-German venture is the first to show such hopeful results. Another U-turn by the British government, this time yielding to a campaign led by Manchester United and England striker Marcus Rashford to extend school meals to disadvantaged kids during the Christmas holiday period. Prime Minister Boris Johnson initially ruled out the support for the most needy, but gave in after cafes and restaurants pledged to do the government's job for it. Over the weekend, Johnson called the young footballer to explain his about-face.
It's obviously most important for the families, and you know, on the phone he kept thanking me, but then in the back of my mind I'm like, it's the families that that deserve the U-turn, and I actually thanked him on behalf of the families, because I know 100% they would have wanted to say thank you to him if they had the chance.
Despite being the world's sixth largest economy, the UK is home to millions living in poverty. Austerity measures have cut support over the past 10 years, leaving services at breaking point. And the pandemic has made a difficult situation worse, fueling anger at the government's initial stance. November 11, 2 days from now, Remembrance Day here in the UK. Millions wear a poppy to mark the occasion. Others don't and have disagreements over its use. More now with Robert Carter, a Brit himself. What's the problem with the poppy, Robert?
Well, there's a massive debate that surrounds this logo. Critics of the poppy say that it has become a pro-war establishment symbol used as British propaganda to basically whitewash the UK's crimes abroad. So you have, for example, the fact that the poppy originally came from the end of World War One, but since then, every single war that Britain's been involved in, since then until now, is used and is commemorated and honoured on the same day. So many of those wars Britain was actually the aggressor in, such as the war and invasion and occupation of Iraq and also Afghanistan, just to name a few, but also right-wing racist individuals and politicians in the UK also adopt the poppy as a kind of symbol of British patriotism against the other, against the foreigner, against Islam, all that type of stuff. You also have war criminals or people accused of being war criminals like Tony Blair choosing to wear the red poppy on a year-on-year basis, and he's responsible for massive deaths of both British servicemen and also native innocent Iraqis and Arabs, just to name a few examples. So a very controversial image it has become, and obviously that's expressed online. I can actually play you an example of this debate raging on British TV recently. It's between a white journalist who was criticizing a black anti-racism activist for just tweeting, questioning the poppy and its legacy. Let's play that out now.
Something you, thanks to them, will never ever have to do. It's entirely different. You are now politicising the poppy, which is entirely the wrong thing to do. People wear them out of respect and out of honour to people. And for you to criticise that, to apply terms like wearing a poppy is a moral absolute. No, it isn't. No one in this country is forced to wear a poppy. They wear it if they want to, and they wear it for a very specific reason.
Go on, Femi.
You're misusing the term moral. I mean, I said moral absolute as in something that is we are morally supposed to be doing.
Well, we're not morally supposed to wear a poppy, but people choose to wear them.
And Robert, some would say the ultimate goal of this poppy patriotism or nationalism is to shut down debate around the UK's foreign policy. What have people been saying online about this?
Well, that's a very fair point you make, and obviously there is a degree of fanaticism surrounding the poppy, particularly by right-wing leaning individuals, as you saw in the interview. Any criticism of the poppy gets hounded and shouted down. Let's go to Twitter. There's been a mixed reaction to this. The first tweet I have, let's bring that on screen now. It's criticism of the poppy, which has been expressed across Twitter. So Dumas says, I used to wear a poppy to honour the men who died in World War One and World War Two, but stopped wearing it in 2003 when Tony Blair invaded Iraq illegally and the UK soldiers occupying Afghanistan and Iraq were rebranded as heroes, quote unquote. Let's go to the next tweet again. Some criticism of the poppy and what it stands for. Let's bring that up now. It's from Leslie, who says, the poppy is often misused by some as a badge of British patriotism. Of course, it is politicized. Many old soldiers refused to wear them as they felt it glorified war. We are a nation obsessed by war. And third tweet is actually on the other side of the debate. It's defending the poppy here. Mike says, I agree with Carol, the journalist in the earlier interview. Our military are not ideologically driven. They do as they're told to do and risk their lives for government, whether they agree with it or not. Recognizing their sacrifice has nothing to do with support campaigns they were in. Obviously, there is disagreement.
Let's talk about a man who also was criticized in 2015 for wearing a poppy that wasn't big enough. Jeremy Corbyn, and tell us what's been happening with him.
So obviously the civil war, which is raging in the Labour Party, is continuing. And the latest that we have is obviously former leader Corbyn is continued to be, he may face a possible expulsion from the party, and he remains suspended for the time being. But senior members within the party apparatus have warned fellow MPs, you are not allowed to speak out about this dispute publicly going forward. So essentially this has been taken by the left within the party to be a censorship of the dispute, and it hasn't been well received online. The hashtag reinstate Jeremy Corbyn was trending over the weekend, and I can bring you some reaction from that hashtag now. Let's bring up that first tweet and see what was said. It's from a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, who has been speaking out, Ken Loach, who says, "With the government in crisis, this is no time for the Labour Party to turn on itself. We call for the party to reinstate Jeremy Corbyn now." The next tweet, interestingly enough, is from Jeremy Corbyn's son, Tommy Corbyn, who has spoken out. He says that Labour, undoubtedly with the backing of Sir Keir Starmer, is attempting to silence any criticism of this completely outrageous suspension for comments that were completely true. Don't let them. This is insane. So obviously strong words from Corbyn's son there. Corbyn as well has been holding back, hasn't spoken about it so much on Twitter, but he has voiced deep concern about how the Labour Party has been acting.
Right, the Robert Carter with those stories. Robert, thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of this broadcast, everyone. We appreciate you spending time with us. I will see you again soon.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, politeness in speech and interactions. Brothers and sisters, your mouth is one of your ways to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The most favorite mouth before Allah is the one most fragrant. So keep your mouth as fragrant as you can. And who said that? It's Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The outward meaning of this saying is that since man uses his mouth to vocalize Allah's remembrance and worship and recite divine verses, he should keep it clean and fragrant. The hadiths, this hadith that we just read, its inward meaning signifies that the mouth, which is one of the ways of relating with the divine paths of Allah's servants, is more favored by Allah when it becomes fragrant with good, clean, and kind speech, and is free from bad utterances, insults, lies, and harshness. See, when we talk about being polite and speaking in a polite manner, it is something completely opposite to and contrary to bad utterances and, you know, using derogatory and insulting phrases and words. And then, you know, lying, of course, we know that it's a greater sin. A tongue that is a lying tongue and a tongue that gets used to of lying can never be polite, you know, polite in its real sense. And then, of course, harshness. Sometimes we see around us people, they, don't necessarily have bad intentions, but they're harsh in their communications. They're harsh when they talk and interact with others. They're harsh when they respond to things. You know, this harshness is something, again, contrary to the politeness in speech that we're discussing. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we're discussing the importance of politeness in speech and interactions. Brothers and sisters, politeness helps us to deal with other people easily and smoothly. It helps us get on with strangers in a crowded place, and it helps us get what we want. So for instance, you know, say please, and you notice that your transaction get easier, right? A lot of times we have experienced that. Politeness is something we learn as children, and we expect to see it in other people too. Now, when we talk about politeness in speech and interaction, you know, there are a few points, you know, I would like to lay down here, which we should keep in mind. Number one is, listen and be understanding. You know, politeness in speech does not really mean that you keep speaking and don't let the other party share their sentiments. No, you have to be a good listener in order to be a polite person. The second one is, avoid negative words. Instead, use positive words in a negative form. You know, we can't say that we never have anything negative to say. No, sometimes we have to point out a fault, right? How do you do that? It's not really the issue of whether we're going to point out the fault or the error or not. No, of course we're going to do that. But how do we do that? You know, keeping your tone positive and making sure that you get the message across to the other person. Number three, say the magic word. And guess what it is? It's called sorry. You know, we all make mistakes here and there. You know, it doesn't bring your self-esteem down if you just say the word sorry. A lot of the problems we see in society are because people are not ready to give in and, you know, just kneel down when they make a mistake. We all make mistakes here and there. Say the magic word, sorry. Number four, use little words to soften your statement. You know, there are little words that we will go over, but you know, there are those key words that you should use in your communication. Last but not the least, avoid finger pointing statements with the word you. And sometimes we end up doing that, you know, in our communication with other people. We're saying you did that, and then we're pointing this finger at them and not realizing what meaning it's going to convey to them. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
As Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris delivered acceptance speeches Saturday night, November 7th, Trump bucked the tradition of congratulating the winners and instead spent the evening tweeting out claims that he won the election and making allegations of fraud. Says John Quigley, writer, in an article published under the heading, Trump faces growing fury over his refusal to concede defeat to Biden. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Increasing levels of anger and frustration were voiced on Sunday, November 8, as U.S. President Donald Trump continued his refusal to accept the election results that show he was defeated. Even as Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris delivered acceptance speeches on Saturday night, November 7th, Trump bucked the tradition of congratulating the winners and instead spent the evening tweeting out claims that he won the election and making allegations of fraud in U.S. election. As CNN reports, Trump so far has refused to accept the election results, waging a legal strategy to contest them in courts and issuing allegations of fraud. There are currently no plans to invite Biden to the Oval Office for the traditional meeting between the incoming and outgoing presidents, a historic sign of the peaceful transfer of power. Aides instead are working to craft ways for the U.S. president to feel validated even in less, including through more rallies. But after claiming publicly that he won the election, sources say Trump is not denying the outcome privately. And two people said Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, who oversaw his campaign from the White House, has approached Trump about conceding the election. On Sunday, November 8, as the claims by the U.S. President Donald Trump continued, many Trump critics began to lose their patience. It is obscene for a president of the United States to talk of a stolen election when he has not put up any meaningful evidence of any more stealing the election, said Stephen Greenhouse, former labor reporter for the New York Times, in a Sunday morning tweet. The president needs to stop putting his narcissistic selfishness over what is good for our nation and our democracy, he added. Stephen King, the famed novelist and an avowed Democrat, was even more blunt in his proclamation. You lost, you miserable, self-entitled, infantile person, King declared. Concede and get the hell out. In a letter to editor at Guardian on Sunday, November 8th, reader Pete Dury in the UK said he fears that Trump's disputing of the validity of the election result is much more insidious than him simply being a bad loser, Dury wrote. By repeatedly denouncing the accuracy of the outcome, even before it has been confirmed, Trump is giving his supporters a green light to spend the next 4 years blatantly defying a Biden government and generally causing public mayhem, on the grounds that Democrats stole the election from Trump and that the new government thus has no Democratic authority of mandate. As such, many fear that mass protests across the U.S., the occupation of public buildings, and intimidation, especially of black communities, by gun-toting Trump and Biden supporters will become a routine occurrence, justified on the grounds that ignoring the undemocratic Biden government is the duty of true American patriots. If tough punitive action is taken against them, they will claim that democracy and liberty are being suppressed by radical leftists in Washington. But if their mayhem is ignored, they will claim that law and order is being undermined due to a weak government enthralled to political correctness and snowflake liberals. Ahead of Biden being declared the projected winner by nearly every major news outlet in the U.S. on Saturday, November 7th, his campaign spokesperson Andrew Bates on Friday, November 6th, said their team was not ultimately worried if Trump, when defeated, refused to leave the White House voluntarily. The United States government, said Bates, is perfectly capable of escorting trespassers out of the White House. According to reports on Friday, November 6th, a viral claim that Pennsylvania had 21,000 dead people on its voter rolls spread across the internet. In some versions of the rumor, those deceased people had voted for the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. The right-wing publication wrote in an article about this issue. Others then cited it as evidence that Democrats were trying to steal the election. Rudy Giuliani, President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, shared the article on Twitter.
I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS, in the first place, because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS, because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. And now while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own. A community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, we need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City. Friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost, and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion, on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer, truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium, namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.